everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators. We've all illustrated for all the major publishers. We've together published somewhere around 75 books, and we've all taught illustration at the university level.
That's right. Each week we come at you guys with listener questions and fascinating topics in illustration. Sometimes we agree, sometimes we argue, but each time you're going to learn something brand spanking new.
All right, here we are. I should let our listeners know that our podcasting schedule, when we drop podcasts, been affected at all. However, we have been on vacation from recording podcasts for 2 months now. So is our first time meeting back together since May, I think.
Well, did we record one in June? 2019 or something like that.
Yeah, no. So we just recorded a bunch of episodes so we could take the summer off. And that's how I think you run a sustainable podcast, that you don't get burned out on it, right?
Seems like
the right thing to do.
Well, and we're still, like we said in the intro, we're still working illustrators, so we have projects and stuff. At some point you got to do some work. Yeah. You know,
exactly. Working here,
stay incredible.
So let's just quick rundown, what'd you guys do this summer, and then we'll get into today's topic.
Go ahead, Lee.
I did a bunch of illustrations, did some painting projects after my Kickstarter finally wrapped up and I got that sent to the printer. It was a huge kind of detox after that. I just wanted to paint with no concept at all. So I started this hot air balloon blimp series of paintings. It's been super fun, kind of just a fine art thing. Entered some more art fairs for next year and gallery. All that stuff is starting to come back, thank God, finally from COVID. And so there is people meeting in, you know, and galleries and parks and public places again. So it's a good thing. So I had to get all that stuff going. And then just truly tried to enjoy a little bit of time here at my new place. I'm in Colorado. And so, traveling to the mountains and mountain bike riding and doing all kinds of stuff. So it's been fun. I don't want to say it's relaxing because it hasn't been. It's just like there's always a little bit of anxiety. I don't know if you guys feel this. Anytime I stop working, I get anxious for some reason. Instead of just like being totally chill and off work, I feel anxious, like I should be doing some new work. It's weird. And then I start doing work, I'm like, oh, I need to take time off. And I can never fully give in to both of them. So it's been as fun as it can be.
Confessions of a workaholic.
Confessions of a self-employed person. Because for years I didn't even take vacations because I was like, what if I use that money and then I don't get hired? Right. Mm-hmm. So
we've all been there.
I'm the same way. It's like, I am too tired to work, but I am too stressed out to like relax. So I won't relax and I won't work and I'm just get more stressed out.
Perfect.
I remember a veteran illustrator once said, cause I had always had these feelings, but never vocalized them, that, as soon as I'd have a lot of illustration work, freelance work coming in, always juggling jobs. And then every now and then it would all go, I'd finish my last project and I'd have nothing. And he vocalized, the panic of when that happens and you have nothing and you're like, okay, so that was a good run. I was an illustrator and now I'm not. And then a week later, you get another job, or 2 weeks later or something, they start rolling in again and then you're busy and you're like, I should have enjoyed that week or two.
Right. But you can't.
And it's tough. Yeah. And that is a dilemma that, freelancers of all walks of life, all self-employed service industry people kind of suffer through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. What'd you do, Will?
We went to Hawaii and I bought these bokeh shells I'm rocking right now.
Nice.
So if you're on YouTube, you can.
He's looking very Panama City Beach right now. It's got an airbrushed t-shirt saying Will, spring break of 88.
We found a really super, super affordable Airbnb. Ironically, because Oahu, the government on Oahu, made Airbnbs illegal on the North Shore, mm-hmm. unless they rent for 3 months. So a lot of people are doing them under the table and having to charge a lot less to get people in there. So we got a smoking deal. And so we did that for a month, and then we went to Utah and went camping with our kids. And that was pretty much it. I started swimming. So now beautiful. I'm swimming laps.
Yeah. Good. Good.
Best exercise there is on the planet.
So me, from May 8th to June 8th, I ran a Kickstarter for the Spaceships book. And this was sort of like a switch in gears, sort of last minute. No, it's a book I'd been wanting to do for a while, but it was like this last minute idea of maybe I have it be more of a, and less of a sketchbook, but more of like a world building book all about how spaceships fit into this larger universe of comics that I've been doing. So I launched that Kickstarter, ran it until June 8th. And then from June 8th until the end of July, I worked on making the book. And then I took a short 4-day trip to New York to meet up with my family. And then we came home, and I've been back at it working on this book and doing freelance work. So my summer vacation was 4 days.
Wow.
And nice. that is... I can't complain, because I think the last 10 years, my summer vacation has been like 5 weeks of like really low level working and not like just hanging out most of the time, vacationing or doing whatever, and like just touching base with stuff, which has been absolutely wonderful and loving it. And I think this summer it was a time to pay the piper type of summer, where it's like, you know what? You're a little behind on things. You got to pay off some stuff. It's time to really get some work done. So that's where I was at.
Been there.
Yep. Yep. So, okay. Should we get down into our, I like how like Lee has zero comment.
I want to get started on this topic. It's a good one.
he's like the horse that's in the chute. You know, at the rodeo.
I know. He's just like, oh,
it's like bucking and like trying to get over the fence before they pull the gate open.
No, here's my new take. You guys can see how long it lasts. I'm a natural, very social person, and I love to talk with people. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to listen a little more instead mm-hmm. of thinking about what I'm going to say and jump in. So I'm thoughtfully pausing.
I'm calling BS on that this one instance, because I saw you typing while I was explaining what was happening during my summer vacation.
I wasn't typing. I was drawing.
Oh, you're drawing. Okay.
That's
by the way.
Doesn't count.
I'm the one that told Lee he needs to listen more. So that's why he's taking my advice.
I'm taking Will's advice.
Let's hit record and let's do a podcast. And Lee's like, uh-huh. I'm all about listening now.
I'm not going to say anything until the closing credits. And then I'll say either I agree or disagree. Right.
Okay, let's get down into it. We got a question from Jennifer, and she is just doing, like, she's asking the question that's already on everybody's mind. And this has been something that the three of us have been going back and forth on and talking about for the last month. And we kept saying, we should record a podcast. And I'll just say this, it's hard getting back to work when you've been not recording a podcast for 2 months. So this is maybe a little belated, but I feel like this AI conversation is going to be with us for the foreseeable future, you know? But let's just get right down into her question. Subject matter, AI art, copyrights, and the future of illustration as a profession. She has some nice words to say at the beginning that essentially says, you guys are doing a great job, and thank you so much for what you do through the podcast, through SVS Learn. So we really appreciate that. We won't bore everybody with you know, our accolades there. But she says, now to my question, I've seen a lot of conversation recently, especially on Twitter, around AI art and how it might become an issue in the art community because it's getting better and better at imitating human-made illustrations. There's this specific AI that's able to emulate an artist's style really well to the point of looking realistically made by said artist, and has even imitated the artist's signature, which is insane. People seem to worry about a few things. Among them, we have, number one, copyrights. Should the AI developer pay the artist since it's using their style? Sometimes to the point of showing their work in the AI catalog as a style option. Where can we draw the line in plagiarism when it comes to a machine that is directly taking from your work, even though they're not copying one specific image, but your entire portfolio? So that's the one side. Copyright, who owns the rights to this work? Number two, is art a threat for artists that work commercially? Some people compare it with websites like Fiverr and stock illustration and believe AI art would never replace a human-made illustration. Others are comparing it with when photography killed painting and believe AI art will steal illustrators' jobs. What do you guys think? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I loved your inputs on NFTs. Thank you. All right, guys. So I think we might have a few people listening to us who just need to get up to speed on what AI art actually is. And here's my understanding of it. There's actually a great video that explains it really well on YouTube. And I want you to search it for it. It's by Vox. And it's called, what was it? I sent it to you guys. It's the AI that creates any picture you want explained. So it's a 13-minute video. And that'll really get you up to speed on what it is. But essentially, I'll tell you what AI art, what the AI isn't doing. What it's not doing is, even before that, this is what it does. You type in a prompt and the AI generates a picture of what you typed in. So you could type in a snowman using a flamethrower burning a candy cane, right? And the AI will chug along for a minute or so and then spit out a picture of either painted or photographed, depending on the different AI machine that you're doing, that looks like a actual snowman with a flamethrower burning up a candy cane. It's that specific, and it's actually scary in some ways. Okay, so how does it do it? What it doesn't do is go search Google for a picture of a candy cane. Search Google for a picture of a flamethrower and a picture of a snowman, and then collage them together. That's not what's happening here. Mm-hmm. What it actually does is it's much more granular and atomic than what that is. What the AI has done is they feed into it. There's like five different phases of what it's doing. They feed into it hundreds of millions of images with descriptions attached to them. Okay. Google has already done a lot of the work here. When you type into Google, give me an image of a snowman. The algorithm has already figured out here's 1,000 pictures of snowmen, right? From stock footage or stock imagery of snowman to like Instagram photos that people have taken of snowman. So now you have this data set of this full spectrum of what an image of a snowman could be. Okay. So this AI just downloads all of that, the data of what the pixels, the RGB individual inputs on the pixels of what makes up a snowman, along with the worded description of what a snowman is. And then what it does is it goes into this, the AI part of it, which is deep learning. It has this raw data. Now it's learning, how to parse between, like, here's pictures of bananas, here's pictures of snowmen, here's pictures of snow globes, here's pictures of candy canes, here's pictures of flamethrowers, right? And it's figuring out exactly its understanding of the different pixels that make that up. But not just that, it's figuring out, this is the difference between a photo and this is the difference between a painting. This is the difference between a 3D render and this is the difference between like anime, right? So it's like very much going into not just the subject matter, but this is the difference between something shiny and this is the difference between something, you know, dull, right? So textures, shapes, colors, all these things. So then it goes into the next stage and that's called the latent space. is what they're calling it. Latent space is where it creates a multi-dimensional understanding of all this data. So in the video that I talked about, it says, you know, a banana is yellow and a balloon is red, right? A red balloon, party balloon. What happens when you have an image that has a yellow balloon and perhaps a banana that's cut in half, right? So now we still have a banana, but it's not shaped like what we think a banana is. And we have a balloon, but now it's different. We realize balloons can be any different color. So what it's doing is making a multi-dimensional map of all these things that it's already learned about: shape, texture, composition, photography versus painting, all this stuff. And it's essentially mapping out all these different connections between these things. And then it goes into the next phase, which is generation. So once it gets the prompt, it can start figuring out, okay, here's all the zeros and ones that we need to put together to apply to this prompt. And then it goes into output mode. And what happens when you that's when you start seeing the image. What happens when you use something like, me and Lee, I know, have used Midjourney to like render images. What happens is you'll type it in and you'll see the percentage of it done. And that first image that it spits out is like blurry, you know, just a blurry, really out of focus image. And essentially that's like it's sort of this randomly generated like noise filter of something. And then it starts plugging in like, okay, we're going to put in our snowman here. Okay, we're going to put in a flamethrower here. And as it starts figuring out, like, you know, this feels more like what I think it should be, it starts adding detail. And it just gets better and better resolution until it's 100% done. And then you've got something that's pretty close. So that is essentially how it works. It's not, I'll just repeat, it's not like grabbing and pulling and collaging. It's actually building something brand new from the ground up that has never existed before, though it looks familiar. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Is that pretty close to how you guys understand it?
Mm-hmm. That was way more than I actually understood. It's just like you press the button, it crawls the web, finds a bunch of stuff, you know, puts together sometimes a shockingly amazing, you know, interpretation of the things you entered. Sometimes a hilarious interpretation. Like me and Jake were trying to mess with it a little bit. And so I was like, all right, let's see what it would put in. We were just testing out prompts and I entered a kid playing with a dinosaur. I'll post these, by the way, if you guys want to see some of the stuff we're talking about, I'll post these images in the story notes. And then also if you're watching it on YouTube, maybe I'll share, if I can find it, I'll share it. But it was hilarious. It's when it tried to combine the kid and the dinosaur, it playing together, it literally combined it to where the dinosaur had like kid legs. Do you remember that, Jake?
Yeah.
It's just so bizarre. And I was like, okay, my job's safe for a little while. Right. You know, I don't know. Hey, by the way, I while you were talking, I went ahead and entered a snowman with a flamethrower. Mm-hmm. I'm going to send it to you guys and we can pull it up on our screen if you want to, Jake.
Yeah. Do you want to share your screen?
Yeah, just share it.
I'll just give it to you. You have the thing. So I just shared it with you. You can share it. Share your screen if you want to.
Oh, nice. Okay. Let me.
So this is in Midjourney and I just entered that exact prompt. The prompt was snowman with a flamethrower. That's all I wrote.
And then anybody that's listening on, you know, a podcast can join us on YouTube to see this on the SVS Learn channel.
Yeah. It's School of Visual Storytelling on YouTube. Here we got. Okay. So this is interesting. If you're just listening, we've got four images here. They all look like, what painted style would you, this is like children's book-ish, right?
Uh-huh. It's weird because I didn't enter any style in. I just entered, here, I'm going to try it again where I say snowman with a flamethrower, what do you think, realistic or something, and see what the difference is.
Yeah, okay. Not do realistic, do, if you actually do something like Unreal Engine render, or something like that, it'll give it a different look. But yeah, these almost look like the proportions here are almost like a Mary Engelbreit type of style that we could get here. This top left corner illustration of the, I would not know that that's a snowman.
Right. Yeah, it's just the body. It's got, sort of like a Halloween version of a snowman. Yeah,
it's got like a pumpkin head, and it's melting from the inside out. But it does have a cool little top hat, so that's kind of interesting. But then these bottom ones, like, yeah, we're getting summer. We're getting summer. There's a little sci-fi flavor to it as well.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and add, we haven't really started talking opinions on it, but I'm going to go ahead and use this as a springboard, because what happened there is exactly, there's so many downsides to this technology. I realize, and I'm sure we're going to get into it, but the upside is that one, I don't care about the three snowmen that look like snowmen. Is that plural for a couple of snowmen? Okay.
Yeah. Snowmans.
Snowman. But the one weird one is the one that I like, because all of a sudden it changes how you think about something.
Right.
And that is where ultimately I land on this technology, is I'm not looking for it to give me the answer. I'm looking at almost to give me the starting point to the question, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So this is interesting, because about a month ago, I was like, Lee, do you know what's going on with AI art Midjourney? This is when Will was MIA somewhere. We couldn't even reach him by cell phone. He was in the mountains somewhere. And Lee's like, what are you talking about? I said, okay, go get an account and go on Midjourney and type, you know, type something in. And you should have seen the look on his face. He was like, the sentence before that, the conversation before that was like, I'm so tired of like, I have to like come up with illustrations. I have to finish this thing.
I was burned out for sure.
Just burned out. I was like, well, you could have, you know, just AI do your job. And he's like, what? And so we went through it and he typed in the prompt for the next illustration he had to make. And it started giving him all these ideas. He's like, I'm going to be done with this job in like a month. He got so excited.
The important thing though, is it didn't give the full finish. Like, it's going to require an artist to really see where the potential is. And I mean, I've used prompts. I'm going to say prompts.
So there's the new one.
Yeah.
In the past. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the one that's like realistic with the Unreal Engine prompt in there. Well, you know, it's definitely a different look, and so it's kind of cool that you can do that. But I had a whole assignment that I used to give as a teacher, and then something I did as a student as well, where I would walk around and I'd photograph spots, stains, bark, things like that, that just offered kind of a starter shape. And then I would be like, oh, that looks like a forest, or that looks like a spaceship. That looks like this or that, a bridge or whatever. And then I would use that as the basis to start building on. I did the same thing with abstract art for a little while. I would enter in like a Mark Rothko painting or Rauschenberg was one of them that I used to enter, and I'd turn it upside down and I'd look for another illustration within those shapes and just use it basically as big starter blocks. And the beautiful thing about that one is it gave me a starting point of color too, because these abstract artists had already, you know, painted this image. And so, but when I flipped it upside down and kind of squinted my vision, I got a whole new take, and that would be my starting point. And so just starting from something rather than starting from nothing is a beautiful thing, and it can you can grow so much by doing that. It gets you out of your own head. I mean, if you look at people's sketchbooks, they draw the same freaking thing over and over in just barely different ways. And then a lot of people, you can extrapolate that to their paintings. It's sort of the same painting every time.
You jumped straight into the positive, which is cool.
What was interesting before we even debated whether this was good or bad or whatever, Lee was like, I'm using this. I could see exactly where I could fit this into my workflow, and this is going to help me a ton. And so I think that's like, if you're already like an accomplished illustrator and you have a style and you're established, like, this is definitely a tool like Photoshop or like Pinterest is a tool in that.
Correct.
Prior to Pinterest, I had just a massive hard drive folder, 8 gigabytes, 10 gigabytes, 13, whatever, of images I'd pulled from the internet and had just organized in, you know, by artist or by subject and whatnot. And that's what I'd go to for reference. Anytime I'd see something cool, I'd stick it in there. Pinterest came along, ArtStation came along, and Behance. And now I have like my favorites where I could just go to these different websites and just see things like favorited, right? So I don't organize them on my hard drive anymore. Prior to having a hard drive, I had a clip file, like a morgue files is what it used to be called. And what that is like series of folders or binders where you find images in magazines, you find images in newspapers, you photocopy stuff from books, and or you know, if you wanted something physical, you'd pull it off from the internet and print it and stick it in these books, and then you'd have all these folders full of reference that you go to. And so your work as an artist is always like you're the digestive force of everything around you, right? You're always intaking and you're always outputting, and your art is only good as what you put inside of you, right? And AI seems to be able to do some of that job for you in ways that you wouldn't, like Lee was saying, expect. And so for that, it's really interesting. It's really cool. I think the big worry that a lot of people have, and even I have sometimes, is it can also be the end point, not the middle point, but it can be like the final image that someone who is hiring an artist for needs.
It's true. I mean, let's go ahead and put out the sort of the worst case scenario that's kind of making the rounds in the news right now, where somebody entered a contest, happened to be here in Colorado, actually, entered a contest. He prompted and prompted and prompted until he ended up with three images that he liked. He had them output on canvas, and he entered them in an art competition, sort of kind of held, kept it hidden on the creation way it was created, or if he did mention it, the judges had no idea what he's talking about.
They entered it into the digital art category, and they hadn't clearly defined what digital art is.
And it's not a misnomer. I mean, that's true. It is digital art. I mean, and so he won anyway. And so that just sparked
he submitted three paintings, actually. He submitted three of them, and one of them won. The other two, I didn't think were quite as interesting as the one that did win. But
it's interesting though, because that is, like you're saying, that's the end point. And, you know, my take on that was I immediately texted Jake and Will, and I was like, check this out, you know, and I was talking about that implications in an art fair where the judges aren't up to speed on what this is. If people start entering that in and the judges think, wow, all of a sudden there's these great new painters that we've never heard of before and they're printing them on canvas and nobody's, you know, we're none the wiser. They are going to displace, you know, the whole goal of an art market, especially a local kind of art market, is to give a place for painters and people that are professional artists to show their work and sell outside of the gallery system. And all of a sudden these people are going to take those spots. There's only a limited number of places in those shows. If they start displacing real artists, that's a problem.
So
now, I would say, can I just jump in? I think it's really important to note, and it's probably fairly obvious, but the point of the finish point in an art contest is a personal statement. And so the consumer, you know, looks at, you know, if they're looking to purchase a piece of art, they're looking for a piece of art that looks good, that they like, that resonates with them. Mm-hmm. It's very different from an illustration assignment where the art is dictated by the assignment. So it's easy for me to believe that AI right now could win an art contest where the image is not constrained.
Specific, yeah.
Right. But illustration is going to take a bit longer. And I'm not saying that it won't get there either.
Right. It's in the beta. I mean, we should mention that. It's just in the beta. It's the starting point.
Yeah.
And that's what's sort of terrifying.
Next year it'll win the illustration.
I mean, there's a I think it's faster than that because I'm already seeing there's another program called Stable Fusion, which is like next level Midjourney. And not as many people are using it because it's harder to like use, right? Mm-hmm. But you can actually upload your own art or specific images and say, we need something that looks like this or that. Mm. Like I saw a guy upload a sketch and essentially say, okay, everything that's sketchy here, I need it to have buildings in it. And everything over here, I need to have like foliage, right? And then the AI filled it in and said, okay, we'll put your buildings here and your foliage here. And now he had essentially the AI rendering for him what he had sketched out, right? Mm. So like that right there is already next level. You're not just mm-hmm. putting in prompts, but you're putting in, you know, compositional notes and stuff like that. And I could see it going to a place where ultimately, like you can upload a sketch, or you could even like pose, you know, there could be like a 3D model of a character, and you just put it in the pose that you wanted, or drop down menu of poses, or you can like manually put the character in your pose and then say, here's a character I designed. Here's like their front, back, side view of it. Put that skin on this character and place them in this environment. And it's just doing all of that for you precisely. Because right now, you know, some of the obvious like glaring problems is Midjourney can't do hands very well. And there's some wonkiness that happens in the eye area and stuff like that. And so you do have to touch it up. But that's all just going to get like figured out. And then I think that the point on top of that is what happens when you feed into it. Instead of images, you feed into it 3D models, right? So now it knows how
it has all the data. Yeah.
And it knows spatial relationships, and it knows, you know, you could go feed into it like drone scans of buildings and of cities and of architecture and rocks formations and all that stuff. And you could just say, you know, I need the Statue of Liberty from this angle, with Spider-Man swinging around like this. And it needs to be rendered in like Todd McFarlane style, and boom, you've got a comic book cover, right? So I think there's, going back to the contest thing, I think the simple solution there is you just have a category that's like AI art. And so you have essentially, you know, like in the Olympics, you would have real humans and then the androids, right? Like this is android competition, this is human competition, or, you know, it's like...
That's interesting. I like thinking about ownership of an image. I remember a while back, and when I say a while back, this is probably 15 years ago, in the Communication Arts Photography Annual, mm-hmm. there was this person who won a series of images, and he was actually an art director, and he had no experience as a photographer, didn't own all the equipment and all that stuff. And so, but he had relationships with local photographers that he worked with as an art director. And so he said, hey, here's what I got. He sketches out a thumbnail, mentions some locations, goes with the photographer. And then, but the photographer is the one taking the picture. And then the debate became who is responsible for that right. artwork. And so this mm-hmm. is kind of the same thing, right? And there was no answer. They both had credit as photographers. Yeah.
I mean, that's as old as like Michelangelo, right? Like he had a workshop with people all elves. Sculpting and working with him. And he was like, essentially, you know, shave a little bit off here, do a little bit like that. And then you even have like Warhol, like he just had...
He didn't get his fingers dirty after a while.
Right, yeah. Right. He's like, I need 25 Marilyn Monroes on my desk, but you know, by noon tomorrow, mm-hmm. and they're in their silk screening and working on stuff. So there's that. And then what is there, you know, what to say to someone who has a style? I mean, you go to Barnes and Noble today and you're going to see a look, and it might be like Klassian, John Klassen sort of style that's kind of filtered into a bunch of other books, right? There's a lot of texture, there's a lot of geometric shapes. Mm-hmm. And can those artists who are influenced by John Klassen really take ownership of their work? I say, yeah. I mean, they're creating their work themselves. They're adding something to that style. They're not, you know, even if they did something very much in his style, they're not like, as long as they're not like one-to-one replicating, you know, a bear that he designed, they're... Right.
Well, they're almost they're using him as sort of the AI starting point, really. Like, okay, I'm going to design a world. It's going to look like these kind of parameters, but we just did it internally. And we talked a lot about that in, I guess the point I'm going to make here is artists are the first ones to get so up in arms about it. Oh my gosh, how dare this, software exists. You don't have to do anything. But then we go to like a convention like CTN, the Animation Expo, and we see like Brittany Lee in a booth, and then we see like 45 mini Brittany Lees who are just, I mean, almost exactly like her. And
who are all doing Mary Blair, from 40 years ago, 50 years ago, right?
Correct.
And not to throw any shade on Brittany Lee, I think she's definitely...
Oh, she's amazing. I mean, she was the starting point of that. So she's the prompt, right?
But I also want to clarify too, like if you're going back to my John Klassen artist mimicry sort of thing, like... I don't knock any artist who's like, I got to get work as an illustrator. Publishers are hiring people who do this kind of illustration. I'm going to bend my style towards that so I can get more work. Like, that is perfectly a legitimate way for an artist to work. But it does come with the pitfall of when the industry shifts and they want something new and fresh, are you going to be able to... Can you keep chasing that for your whole career, or does it make sense just to find what you make and let that, sort of become known for being the artist that makes the style that you make, right? Mm-hmm. So there's two ways to go about it, and artists have had success in both, and there's also pitfalls in both, because if you are the artist that does one style and that style goes out of style, then you're not getting work anymore. So,
It goes back to what Will was saying about Brad Holland back in the day. There was a bunch of mini Brad Hollands. Did they pivot when Brad Holland wasn't the flavor of the month anymore?
Right.
I don't think they did, because I've still got some of those illustration annuals, and I don't recognize any of those names.
So they became obsolete as well. Correct. Coattail riding, just riding into the sunset and gone.
Right. Yeah. Let me ask you guys a question real quick. This is a debate that I was seeing on Facebook this morning, and I was participating in this little conversation. If somebody's not an artist already, and now they've got access to this, and they type it in, and they get the results like that guy did who won the contest, is he an artist? Is it okay for him to say he's an artist? Is he not an artist? How do we define that? Do we need to define that?
I really believe that what your value is to a client is your experiences that you've had in life. That's really what it comes down to, is the way that you synthesize your experiences and take the assignment that you're given, and you're going to bring something totally unique and fresh. And so I would tend to think that someone who maybe somebody older, maybe the AI would really help someone older coming in to being an artist who's lived and who's experienced a lot. Maybe it would help them fast track them into becoming an artist.
Here's sort of my take on that. Not everyone who's creative can make art, and not everyone who can make art is creative. Right. So I see really good technical artists who can do like, a 13 by 15 charcoal image of an eye, and it's just rendered out beautifully. And that's super cool. But you can get pretty much the same effect by a large format printer doing the same sort of thing. Right. They're not a something like that doesn't quite move me like an illustration that's really saying something, or a piece of art that's really saying something.
And
right?
And then you get into, which is something that I've been preaching in my creativity class that I just released this year on svslearn.com, and that is, there's a lot of assignments and a lot of text that we're given mm-hmm. Where the illustration should not match the text exactly, to make the illustration more exciting and more interesting, mm-hmm. you tell another story within the text that you're given. And the example mm-hmm. I use is, and I'll have to describe it visually, but it's in the book that I did, Bonaparte Falls Apart, where, you know, it's just the story of this little skeleton, and his problem is that it, you know, whenever he's doing activities, his bones fall apart, right?
Right.
And so sometimes his arm will fall off, sometimes his foot will fall off, sometimes his head will roll away. And so the text was, and I'm going to not get it precisely, but sometimes his bones rolled away and he had a hard time finding them. Okay. Mm-hmm. I struggled with that. I'm like, well, what bone is going to fall and roll away? All right. Mm-hmm. So I looked at a leg bone, but if it's attached to a foot, it's not going to roll very far because the foot's going to, you know, hang it up.
Right.
Same with an arm. It could be the pelvis because it's kind of round. Mm-hmm. I played with that, but he can't hold together without a pelvis. Mm-hmm. And so
it's like a linchpin
bone. Yeah. Yeah. So quickly it became the head. But not just making the head roll away. That's the linear way to solve it, right? Mm-hmm. The more creative way to solve it was, I had his head roll away and it was under the bed, but his head could still see his body, but his body couldn't see his head. Mm-hmm. This is not mm-hmm. in the text at all, right?
Right,
right, right.
And I put a basketball in there that his hand is just about to touch. So mm-hmm. he's about to find his head and his body's going to think, oh, good, I found it. Mm-hmm. And the viewer has to fill in, well, when he puts the basketball on top right. of his neck, it's not going to be right.
Right. Okay. We'll see.
Now, what do you guys think of that with in reference to AI?
Yeah, well, what I you're describing is something that AI is not capable of doing
yet.
Well, that's going to be the difference. And that was the point I made on that Facebook thread. I said that this technology, if somebody comes to it with no experience, they're going to be able to make better art than they could have otherwise done. Right. I mean, that's a mm-hmm. given, but where it's going to excel is in the artist's hands. The artists are going to be the ones who make great art. Now, maybe they make the scene using AI and then they fill in what you're saying here, which is very, very specific. And I don't see the AI doing that quite yet, you know, doing it well.
Right.
But, you know, gets you halfway there, gives me a color palette, gives me sort of a setting for the room. And then mm-hmm. all of a sudden I add those narrative bits on top and all of a sudden it's a kind of a win-win. Yeah. I just texted you guys it's just a straight up drawing by Scott Robertson, but he's using some AI by, let's see, it's called, if you go to app.wombo.art, it allows mm-hmm. you to enter your own art in there. And then it has a bunch of different kind of settings like gouache, realistic, comic book, even Studio Ghibli. But you're starting with your own base, and he's messing with it. And granted, there's no narrative to his stuff. He's like kind of does, you know, spaceships.
Artist.
He's a concept yeah. artist, does a lot of vehicles. I mean, he's the guy to go to for that kind of stuff. But what it made was something far more interesting than I think any of his other art is in terms
you
of just
see
art.
That on someone blowing that up and putting it on a wall.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
and
like,
so, yeah, but yeah. it's him. I mean, it's, and so it's kind of the example that I'm leaning towards where this thing excels is when it's the combination of the artist and the technology getting you somewhere maybe you wouldn't have gone mm-hmm. elsewhere. I mean, it's right. the same thing also as music using that. Remember when digital music came out and auto-tune and all that, even just like stock music and DJ kind of things where you're looping stuff together and you're creating stuff, a mismatch of stuff. It didn't kill music. It didn't do right. anything to music except for make it better and make it more diverse.
Right.
I think let me just insert this really quick that, you know, Photoshop made my life better in that it literally allows me to make images twice as fast. Right. Mm-hmm. And I see this AI really making, cutting that time again, probably. Mm-hmm. I can imagine if I learn to use it, cutting my time into a fourth or even less. Mm-hmm. So and the benefit there is then you have time to start another business, mm-hmm. have right. more time with your family. I think mm-hmm. it makes your life better in many ways. And I think that it's the tendency is to just look at the negatives and to go to fear.
I want to go back just to go back to what I was. I didn't think I fully expressed my thought, but the artist who does the mural size painting of an eye, right? That you could absolutely just print out on a large format printer and have sort of the same thing. I think the value there isn't so much in the image that they're creating, but the way that they're creating it. So when I see like these Instagram artists or these TikTok people and they're like, you know, spending hours stippling a really photorealistic image, like the impressive thing there isn't that I chose this to make a portrait of this person. It's that they spent 40 hours working on, you know, working on this thing. And that's what they devoted their time to. Right. And so AI can't replace that, like that human element that a person chose to spend their time doing that. And look at all the craft and artistry that went into making that. Right. It's just way more impressive. And you, honestly, you know, if you're an art buyer, and you have the money, you're going to want an original handmade thing versus a print.
Right.
Right. And I think moving forward, if you have the budget and you have the money, whether you're a producer working on a film or or an art collector or an editor who wants an illustrated book, you're going to want the thing made by a human because there's a artisanal factor there that you're not getting from AI. Now, if you're in the business of, listen, I just need to crank something out. I need ideas fast. I was only hiring artists in the first place for idea generation. Now AI kind of fills that void for them, you know, could fill that thing for them. So in a sense, yes, it's stealing art or stealing jobs from certain artists, but it's also in a way making art made by humans more valuable.
That's true.
Because it's rarer and it's more, you know, it's more unique. So if you're creating art that can easily be replicated, that can easily be taken over by AR, your sort of focus now as an artist is how do I make art that has value? Or how do I find the people who value this kind of art that I'm making? That's sort of like your job now as an artist. And you guys, like you specifically, Will, you've lived through an industry like upheaval, like a flip in the industry. How did you weather that? And what was it?
Yeah, like when they invented the camera. What'd that feel like, Will?
Yeah. You were doing like...
I see what you did there. We had this talk earlier that... because I'm the more seasoned veteran here, that I have a lot more wisdom, so they like to poke fun. The stock. Are you talking about stock illustration?
Stock illustration and just editorial illustration, kind of like
Photoshop, collided at the same time.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, like
you left art school with able to do $300,000 a year in illustration work, and
not that much.
$500,000
Going the wrong way. No, I did really well. I did six figures in editorial work, and I realized what happened was 1 year. It was like 2 years as an illustrator, and then the first catalog for SIS, which was Stock Illustration Source, came out. And prior to that, it was photographers going, "Oh, they're taking over our career," and I'm like. And when I was in school, I'm thinking, this is why I want to go into illustration and not photography, is because, the stock illustration is a thing and it's decimating careers out there and forcing photographers that were doing, you know, generic work to do more specific work. But then when it came into illustration, I saw the writing on the wall. I was doing anonymous figures, which is what business clients wanted. Which is what business magazines wanted. So the more the Brad Holland look. And you guys can Google Brad Holland. Little people, paintings, guys in business suits or white ties and women in business suits. And doing a concept. So it was like little people with big objects was like the thing back then. And, you know, and then all the illustrators that were doing those were taking those images that they had done for magazines and sending them to the stock catalog. And I'm like, so these images are never going away. These concepts mm-hmm. are going to build over time, and the catalog is going to get bigger. And the next year, so it was about the first year was like an eighth of an inch. Mm-hmm. The second year was an inch of images, and it, mm-hmm. and it grew from there, you know. And then there were other companies getting into it, and so I switched over to children's books because my theory was, instead of doing a one-off image that is of one concept, mm-hmm. if I do a narrative where I have to hold a character throughout a book, you can't do that. You can't sell that in stock. And stock never did compete in the publishing, the narrative publishing world. Mm-hmm. But it's a long story, but I told a lot of other illustrators, the children's book market is going to get really competitive as the rats flee the ship of the sinking ship of editorial, and editorial got decimated. I mean, it was, you know, it's today it's probably 5%, if that, of what it used to be. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of careers that had to change, and a lot of artists, a lot of illustrators at that time that I have a friend that became a banker, you know, they just went and got a job at a bank. Mm-hmm. Another friend who was really heavy into illustration or into the editorial world, opened a gallery. They were forced to make these right turns in their careers, you know?
Yeah. That's always going to happen though. I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's AI or some other thing that comes in, there's always going to be a shift and you're always going to have to pivot. I mean, I always use the analogy in my classes. At some point, somebody was making the last of the horse and buggy carriages.
Yeah.
And they probably were great. They were probably the best company out there making them. But
the propaganda at the time was, don't buy an automobile. Right. Don't do it. And there will be people that the artists that say, don't succumb. Don't use the tool. Don't use the AI tool. Right.
Right.
And you're not going to stop it. That's one thing. I had a professor at the school I went to at BYU who said that the one year I can't remember. It would have been 19. I'm going to date myself. Probably 89. And he said, he was a graphic design teacher. The computer will never be used to spec art, it'll never be used to create graphic design. He got laid off the next year.
And they hired
the Mac was, a couple students had Macs and they were like, hey, so we can do our assignment on the computer. He wouldn't let them.
Wow.
You know, and he just,
what
he
a narrow sided, yeah, like,
I'd give his name. He was a jerk, but I don't want to be a jerk as well. But, he was a jerk to a lot of people and, you know,
I first saw AI images like posted on ArtStation, like in January. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. Oh, this is kind of cool. Like, this is some weird stuff that they're making that's like pretty neat. You know, I didn't know how they were doing it or what they were using, because back then it was like these, you know, it wasn't open beta. It was like, we're handpicking different artists to kind of help us build this, you know, this system. And so let's see what they can do with it. About June, I want to say, is when it really, like, for Midjourney, it became open. Like you could sign up and within a few days get an account to like make the art. And that's when I started seeing a lot of this discussion on Twitter, like, oh my gosh, you know, this is the end. This is the end of it. Right. And then a couple weeks later, someone posts this Atlantic article that the illustration for the article, the editorial illustration, was done in Midjourney. You know, made by prompts from Midjourney. And then everybody online was saying, oh, well, now it's the end, right? And then I saw someone tweet like, all right, my students are turning in artwork for their assignments that's clearly made in, by AI. Uh-huh. And still people are like, okay, now it's the end. And then the New York Times article about this Colorado guy who wins the art contest. Now it's the end. And all this has happened within the span of like a couple months. And I think just going down this thread is this landscape is changing, but also in this time span of these last few months, I'm still being called upon for my art abilities to design specific things by companies that have just as much access to artists who could do AI, artists or them art directors who could do AI themselves, but still they're wanting some sort of human element to the things that I'm creating, as well as my Spaceships Kickstarter book launched in the middle of all this AI like panic. And that book made over $80,000 on Kickstarter, right? So it's like you can be worried, and you should definitely pay attention to what's happening here, but it's not going to go away. You can't wish it away. You can't just turn this off and say, you know, boycott AI or whatever. It's just going to be a component of life now. And you as an artist need to figure out, what can I make that has this human element that you can't get from AI? You know, if I came out with a spaceship book that was all AI generated, like all these, you know, 100 spaceships all generated by AI, you know, my unique prompts and here's what I designed. Is that something someone's really going to want versus, you know, some of the stuff that I created from my own imagination? Or, you know, would I be more successful if I used AI as a tool and helped me generate ideas that then I then filtered through my own style and my ability? So I think there's a lot of options here. Lee, you posted a few more of these things.
Yeah, if you want to share this, because this is just this will be our little fun little interlude. If you want to post, so Jake's sharing his screen right now. So I sat down with my son just messing around. He's 11, getting ready to be 12, and I was like, son, this thing will make images of whatever we say instantly. And I was like, let's play. And so, you know, just use, instead of being so scared of it, just like using it again, just as a play tool, see what an 11-year-old will come up with. So this prompt that we're looking at here was a spider cake. Those are the two words that he put together. And then we did a high res render of that one on the lower left, which is shockingly awesome.
Wow.
And creepy.
It's so creepy and so awesome at the same time. And we just were having a blast with it.
What flavor is that?
I don't want to know.
Vanilla frosting on this nasty spider base with these huge eyes. But we were having such a good time with it. The next prompt he entered was, and this shows the limitation of it in its the pure limitation of the software. The prompt for this one, get this, is a chihuahua riding a monkey. And so if you guys see this, it is the most surreal, terrifying.
You put riding a monkey.
Riding a monkey. Yeah, a chihuahua riding a monkey. And it combined the monkey. It combined the chihuahua, monkey, and I don't know what else. It almost looks
and
like
then it threw a saddle
octopus.
On it.
That one,
one of them has a helmet.
That so one makes bizarre. You feel like you have job security for a little bit longer. Right.
This was kind of the result that I got when, when Jake and I entered a kid playing with a dinosaur. It's just so far off of what you're trying to get to that if I needed a chihuahua riding a monkey and I'm an AI artist and that's what my client is asking for. What prompt do I enter besides chihuahua riding a monkey that gives me a chihuahua riding a monkey? Right. If this weird morphed crazy, like nightmare surrealist version is what it's given me, I don't know how else to, maybe that's what people will learn, is how to sort of manipulate the prompt to nudge it in the right direction. I don't know how to do it because that's what I got when I entered that. So,
well, it'll solve that. I mean, definitely. And there's probably other software programs that would nail it. But let me offer an observation and what I think is a really bright spot in this discussion. And that is, I think illustrators or creatives in general, creative people limit themselves by thinking that their creativity only applies to their art. And what I mean by that is I let me give you an example. I'm working with a guy right now on a book project. And he and his family own a game company, and they're very successful. They sell thousands and thousands of their board games and have done really, really well. And one of the things that he did was he took his skill in game creation, and he was at Crumble Cookies one day, and he was like, I think there's a cookie game that could be done with Crumble Cookies. And and I'm gonna approach the owner and that team and try to figure out if there's a collaboration. It's launching. You know, he's launching that. Right. And so I think that what artists do is we focus on like the creativity of the craft and of what we're making, but we forget about being creative in the marketplace. And that's really where you see like so many artists thriving and making really good money, but they're not waiting to be picked. They're picking themselves and I'm stealing that from Seth Godin's Linchpin book. They're picking themselves and saying, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to make this thing and I'm going to give it to the world. Right. And I'm going to take it to market. And there's creative ways of doing that. You can take it to market on your own through crowdfunding. Like, you know, Jake, you just launched your Kickstarter. Or you can approach a company like he did. It wouldn't have happened if he wasn't the artist who developed his skills in creativity. And he's also a really good graphic designer. He developed those skills and his entrepreneurial creativity. That's what's missing from a lot of artists. And those artists that aren't willing to adapt and be creative and think outside the box and not wait for the world to come to them, but they go out there and do their thing, they're going to thrive while other people are going, yeah, I stole my job. So there's going to be people that are winning, and you want to be one of those of you.
It's a good point. If you're basically saying if you're an artist and you can just be replaced because a machine made a pretty image, well, how much of an artist actually were you in the first place? You know, I'm signing on with a new agent right now she's a literary agent, and she's asking for my writing. There is nothing I could enter in an AI software that would be the next step for how I'm working with this person. I need to present a manuscript or at least pitches for story ideas and things like that. And so, you know, like kind of backing up what Will's saying, there's still a whole big thing aside from the image creation. I think so many artists do get caught up in, oh, here's the color I used. Here's the image itself, but it is it's everything. It's not just the image.
Right. Yeah. I see these people who are in art school right now, and they're like, this is where, you know, this is the field that I'm going into, and they're discouraged because they're like, what will I have to offer to this? And I think what makes a great artist for the last 1,000 years and what's going to make a great artist for the next 1,000 years is your life experience translated into images. And some people might use AI to do that. Some people might not use AI to do that. But at the end of the day, you're going to be competing with someone who knows how to oil paint, but also someone who knows how to put prompts really well into a computer. And what are you going to do to give yourself, you know, to make yourself be able to compete in that environment? You will find if you're like what the three of us are saying, you'll find a way to get work and to use your creativity to contribute to society in some way. I think that's possible. I think it's there. One example I could think of is AI. I don't see as being like an end-to-end problem solver let's say in the entertainment industry. We could do even in like illustration, children's book publishing. It's not going to be an end-to-end thing. You're not going to have a children's book author typing in their manuscript into AI and getting all the images back that they absolutely were hoping for and expecting, right? Mm-hmm. characters aren't going to stay on model, backgrounds aren't going to, you know, match. So there's still going to need to be somebody with some sort of art ability that happens in the middle there to make sure everything, and I'm saying this is like, if they really want to go the AI route to save money, they're still going to have to hire someone who knows Photoshop or someone who knows something to kind of tie it all together and prep it to print. And,
you yeah. think that's exactly. going to be, I wonder if that's going to be an official job. Like you're an AI sort of retoucher or something like that, where you're the guy that's brought, yeah, you got to just make it into something that's, you know,
Chihuahua
riding
side,
a monkey.
Right. On the entertainment side, like a production needs to have at the end of the day, something animated to, or some sort of visual effect or some sort of actor in an outfit on screen, right? And so yeah, a producer can just plug a bunch of prompts into, you know, put the whole movie script into Midjourney or Stable Diffusion or whatever these things are, and they're going to get back maybe some results that are actually good, but then someone's going to have to build it practically. You know, they're going to have to design the mask that the person's going to wear. They're going to have to design the space car that they're going to, you know, get in and fly. They're going to, you know, there's still going to be people who need to translate what these things are making into something actually applicable and usable. So I kind of look at it as like, this opens up more jobs for people in the future who are creative, but not necessarily crafty, right? Does that make sense? When I worked at Blue Sky Studios, we had 300 to 500 people at the time working on animated films. And there was an art department, and these were the people who knew how to draw with, not even with pencil and paper, but you know, digitally, right? So even there, it like had evolved from 20 years prior to that. But I knew amazing artists who may not have been as good at drawing as the people in the art department, but who could light a scene beautifully. Just they knew the exact way to like place a light in a scene, what intensity, what color of the light, and how the shadows, you know, drape and fall over the figure to like emphasize certain areas. Like that was an artist using digital tools to create their art. Could they sit down and paint a portrait? Probably not. But could they light a beautiful scene? Yes. So essentially these digital tools gave a job to someone who was an artist who might not have been able to have a job as an artist 50 years ago. Right. So right now, this is opening up possibilities for people who are creative, who are artists, but aren't the kind of artists we traditionally think is artists. Mm-hmm. So, should we wrap it up there? Is there anything else we need to say about this?
If you were making an AI program, what would be a name that you'd throw out there?
While you're thinking of that, I just want to touch, going back to the question from Jennifer, because this is all kicked off by Jennifer. Just going back to the copyright part of it, should you be able to plug into AI and say, I want to make a Lee White style illustration and be able to submit that to their, you know, to their publishers, like here's something that I can create.
And they're already doing that with that was our Brittany Lee example or John Klassen. Mm-hmm. Everybody's already done that anyway. So it's not like the AI is changing that or that everybody had their own individual style.
Right.
Out of the bag.
Right. Yeah. So I guess our stance on that, our flag in the sand is, what are you going to do?
Well, let me use a better analogy with what people are concerned with the copyright. It's the same argument as if I had, because it's using so many images. Now, it is using images in a database as a starting point, right? So maybe my image is part of that, and Will's and Jake's and yours too. But I use the example of if I had a magazine right here, I can't just rip a page out and say, okay, this is my image, right? Somebody else made that image. It's just one image, one page. But if I took the whole magazine, ran it through a shredder 5 different ways, and then it's all just little dots on a piece of paper, and then I compose a portrait out of those little dots of shredded paper, Is that a copyright violation at that point? Of course not. So it's the same exact thing it's doing.
Yeah. All right. That problem solved. And I think we answered the question of whether or not this is a threat. It's a threat for people who aren't creative, and it is a tool for people who are creative. And I that's it in a nutshell. And here's my name for a AI program that creates art. I'm going to call it Rando Distribo.
Rando Distribo.
Distribo.
I'm going to go with Distribo. I'm going to go with Kaleidoscopic.
Okay, oh, you beat me. Good. That's pretty good. Kaleidoscopic.
Okay. Oh God, now I got to come up with something to beat Kaleidoscopic all of a sudden. That's
how about good. How about how about this motif explosion?
Or you could go something like mashed potatoes or something.
Some kind of cue off the, like, isn't there the particle accelerator kind of thing that takes data and or matter and change? So some kind of accelerator.
But the there's no ER, it's just R, and the R is lowercase, right?
Right.
Trademark. Art accelerator. What was the other one we prior to? It was Genesis.
Genesis with a 3 as the E,
and every I is actually a Y.
We do have a naming service company that we need to start now, guys. We need this is our springboard. See, being creative.
How about Candy Blender?
Candy Blender.
I like Candy it. Blender. See, AI has taken our illustration jobs, and now we're going to be a naming.
What's the studio. Name of our name generating business?
Oh God.
Name generator .LLC. It's so dumb.
Let's wrap it up.
We name it.
Wrap it up. All right. You come up with it, we name it. We should have
I should add that we too. We actually paid a company to name our own company, and then that company named it the same thing that we already named it.
Right.
But they did really good. They came up with some really good names that we couldn't use for reasons.
Correct. That is true.
Mm-hmm. So to give them credit, they did a
We would have used their name if we were starting from scratch.
We
from
essentially scratch, yeah. hired someone to tell us our name is fine the way it is.
Yeah, even though we don't like it. Not three-point perspective.
Bleep that out, Daniel.
That's SVS Learn.
We like it.
SVS Learn.
It happened to me the other day, by the way. Someone was like, SV what? SVC? No. SVS. And I had to finally write it down because they were hard of hearing.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Sort of. FVF? Yeah. Like Frank? Yeah. Victor like Frank? What? No.
SES? SVS. What's the what's the military numbering system? It's
SOS.
No, it's like Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, but
Bravo.
Yeah, what would it be for SVS? Would you guys know? It's like Victor Sam.
I think
Sam. Yeah, something like that. So maybe that's what we start calling it.
Sam Victor Sam naming.
This needs to end.
Let's put this out of its memory.
All right, everybody, thank you for joining us. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by SVS Learn. That's samlearn.com. Where becoming a great illustrator starts. Your hosts today have been Will Terry, and you can find his work at willterry.com. Lee White, and you can find his work at leewhiteillustration.com. And I'm Jake Parker, and you can find my work at mrjakeparker.com. Podcast is produced by Daniel Tu. That's Daniel T-U, and you can find his work at daniel2.co. Special thanks to Keeper of the Curriculum, Austin Shirtlift, Chief Operations Officer, Lisa Fott. A thank you to Lily Howell for our show notes and our customer service rep. Is that what we're calling her?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Annalise. I think that's it. Now, go draw something. So we moved in to this house in Arizona, and everything's good. Things are going. 1 month into it, we get the energy bill, and it's $800.
And Allison's like, nah, this is wrong.
What? And I was like, what? $800 a month for electricity?
Wow. Oh, my.
What the heck? And so she's like, something's wrong. Something's got to be wrong. So she calls up. She's like, I think we were overcharged. Can you just check and see what the, what the history for this house is? And she's in there doing it, clicking around. And she's like, yeah, 800, that's about right for summer.
I picture August. Elaine from Seinfeld going, it be right.
It was, she's like, that's about right for August. You know, you guys are running your air conditioner. And we're like, what the heck? This is not, we didn't budget out for an $800 a month energy bill. And so then we came to find out that the air conditioning we were using was 20 years old.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Maybe a little bit older than 20 years old. It was the original to the house.
Wow.
And it was like low on all the performance levels, you know, for what it. So it was just cranking as much as it could to like keep up with the needs of heat and everything. And so
that's where that's we are.
That's when we replaced it.
And now you're 400.
350, something like that. Yeah, shaved off a good $450.
Too shabby.
Anyway, middle-aged banter is what we're doing here.
How about those taxes?
I'm not talking about the sports game. Or I will say this before we get started. There's this whole thing going on with Olivia Wilde and Harry Styles and Florence Pugh, who are these Hollywood actors and actresses, right? And there's this movie thing that's happening, right? I couldn't care less. I don't know how the saying goes. There's no way I could care less than what I care right now about this. Mm-hmm. Yet. Someone I saw a thread on Twitter that just kind of explained the drama that's happening on set of this movie, and I couldn't stop reading it either.
give me the nutshell
at the Venice Film Festival.
That's part of it. The nutshell is this: Olivia Wilde is an actress. She's directing. I don't know if it's her first movie she's directing or whatnot, but she hired for the two main leads, Florence Pugh and Shia LaBeouf,
uh-huh.
Right?
Oh, he's always in a mess.
Right. The guy is trying to clean up his life now. Like he's on a, mm-hmm. he's turning things around. I think he's seen how you could really ruin your life, and he's taking steps to like make it better, right?
Oh, okay.
So Florence Pugh says, no, I'm not working with this guy. He makes me uncomfortable. And Olivia Wilde says, no problem. We'll let him go and we'll replace him with, I think, Harry Styles, who she has a relationship with. This is like high school stuff happening now, mm-hmm. right? So Shia LaBeouf is like, what? I'm getting replaced? This is not like...
This is playing out in social media.
Yeah, the reason being he was replaced was because she's super uncomfortable with doing certain scenes with him, and he's sort of standing up for himself. He's like, this is not how it goes. Olivia Wilde actually wanted me to stay on this show, and she's trying to manage. Miss Flo is what they call Florence Pugh, right?
Uh-huh.
Now now there's these conflicting stories, like who's right, who's wrong. He said, she said. Well, a video was unsurfaced of Olivia Wilde talking to, like doing a video message to Shia LaBeouf, where she's begging him to stay on the film. And,
oh, that's so good.
And how she's like pretty much lied to Florence Pugh. So now there's like, so that's out. And at Cannes, you've got you've got her not showing up to certain events and showing up to certain events, but not even making eye contact with the director.
Oh, no.
And so it's just like all this stuff. What a mess. I don't care at all about it, but yet I can't like...
Now you care.
I can't turn away from it.
Well, that's the train wreck kind of philosophy. You can't help it. I mean...
Yeah. Yeah. It's like it so doesn't matter. It's so unimportant.
You know, if you just do the right thing and don't lie... These mm-hmm. things don't happen.
Yeah. I mean, and then it just keeps escalating. Like, that's just, like, the core of it. Then there's this video where it looks like Harry Styles spits on Chris Pine's lap.
But and he doesn't?
Chris Pine's in the film. And everyone's, it's like, it's called Spitgate. And everyone's what? Like, did he spit or did he not spit? They can't tell.
Oh, my goodness.
Is Chris, is there any movie that Chris Pine isn't in right now?
He is
the hot ticket right now.
He's pretty hot ticket. I saw a tweet where someone's like, please explain this to me in NFL terms. I don't understand what's going on. And it's like,
somebody okay, drew it out.
So the head coach of the Steelers is sleeping with the quarterback. But, and he, you know, and it's like, and Chris Pine, he's just the tight end. He's nose to the grindstone, just trying to make it through the season.
Just trying to make it through the season.
It's so funny. Okay. Should we start this podcast?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Well, I was going to say is I've heard some of the music that the younger generation listens to. And I know this is old man shouts at cloud type of stuff, but I think AI could really do a better job.
What do you mean?
Go elaborate on that. What do you mean?
Well, do you ever hear those songs where it's like there's just like this you know, ticking noise where it's like a tick 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 tick, and then there's just a guy who's just like who probably just woke up from an all-night bender on whatever, and he's just like, I'm in the middle of it. I'm going to do it. It's a bit. Now everybody come in. And it's like, you know, it's just like, right. I don't even know what kind of music that is. I'm like, what is this? I'm sure there's someone listening.
German techno kind of thing.
Well, that guy's making $100 million this year.
Yeah, he figured it out. Maybe I need to do my own album.
It's crazy.
I saw this one TikTok where the guy's like, you don't need music theory. And he has like a, you know, one of those essentially like GarageBand, but the professional version of it. He's like, you just pick the instruments you want and you just click random notes here and watch, I'm going to hit play. And it's all, he's like, yeah, maybe you do need theory.
Maybe you did need theory.